Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The universe, it turns out, has a weight problem.
This is the universe. It's really, really big.
Yeah, but the universe doesn't look as big as it is. That's right. The universe weighs way more than it looks. Way more. What's its secret? Dark matter. It's not a dieting tip. It's the secret at the center of the universe. Looking for dark matter in all the right places. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 25th, and we get a glimpse of dark matter from the master himself, Neil deGrasse Tyson of WGBH's Nova. Also, inflation in the Fed, an overture to Iran, good news for the Everglades, and reporting on the heroes among us. Technology meets good intentions and aims to start a revolution. That and all the news. President Bush and Iraqi President Jalal Talabani are meeting in Washington today to discuss a long-term security pact and a legal basis for U.S. troops to stay in Iraq after the United Nations mandate expires on December 31st. International criticism of Zimbabwe's troubled election process is growing. Neighboring countries in southern Africa are meeting today. They are likely to recommend a transitional government. Even though his opponent dropped out, President Robert Mugabe says Friday's runoff elections are a go.
We will proceed with our election. Other people can say what they want, but the elections are ours.
The U.S. says it will not recognize election results from a one-party vote.
The U.S. Senate could pass a foreclosure rescue bill as early as today, though President Bush has vowed to veto it. Senate Banking Committee Chairman and Democrat Christopher Dodd.
It's not going to solve everyone's problems, but it can make a difference in saying to the American people, we hear what you're saying and we're doing something about it.
The bill would back $300 billion in new, cheaper loans for about 400,000 high-risk borrowers. Police in Henderson, Kentucky, say this morning a disgruntled employee shot and killed four co-workers at a plastics plant before killing himself. Two others were injured.
Today, Tibet reopens to tourists 3 months after the Chinese government banned visits, citing security concerns. The first group of tourists to arrive today are from Sweden.
In Asia, oil prices are holding steady at nearly $137 a barrel, the lowest consumer confidence numbers in 16 years, pushed U.S. markets down yesterday, but not by much. Markets are waiting for the result of the Fed decision later today. The S&P opens at 1314. But we want to talk about heroes this morning. The idea of, have you seen someone perform a selfless act and you wanted to tell somebody about it? There are places you can report what heroes do. One of them is 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll be talking about another one later in the show.
We certainly will. Have you had any hero experiences?
I have had a hero experience, and I may be talking about that later in the show. But if you have a small-scale hero experience, and if you could go to a map and see where heroes are reported all over the world, what would it mean to you? We're going to talk about that later in the show. But you can tell your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake at the, what's it called?
I'm not going to help you out.
Oh, you're not going to.
TheTakeaway.org.
So mean, TheTakeaway.org. The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. 30 years ago, the Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The so-called FISA courts are up for reauthorization, and the Senate may vote on the reauthorization of the FISA courts later on today. The FISA Act, and those particular courts are at the center of a number of debates that emerged after September 11th and the Bush administration's handling of U.S. security. There are certainly a number of lawsuits that were spurred by the Bush administration's use of the FISA courts. And in some sense, the legislation that's being dealt with in Congress today is a way of dealing with some of those lawsuits and concerns. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act has already been passed by the House of Representatives, and among the provisions, among the controversial provisions, are providing immunity from for telecommunications companies from being sued for sharing or for conducting illegal wiretapping or federally authorized wiretapping on behalf of the Bush administration. Joining us now is Maryland Senator Benjamin Cardin. He's going to vote on this bill, is considering the bill. He's also a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What do you make of the House compromise on this FISA Act, and how different might the bill be in the Senate?
Well, there's no question that the House improved the bill. Certainly, the civil liberty provisions and the oversight provisions on the authority given to the president has been improved. I particularly appreciate the adding of exclusivity, meaning that this is the exclusive way in which the president can use the foreign surveillance. The problem, quite frankly, is that the Bush administration has abused the power of its office on spying on, in some cases, Americans. And we're trying to make sure we have the right authority so that the intelligence community can get the information which is important to protect us. We want to do it in a way that protects the civil liberties and privacy of the people of this country.
Senator, some will look at this compromise, though, and think that in a certain way, it actually is allowing for some of the abuses that the Bush administration conducted. It's basically providing legislative basis for some of the behaviors that were so controversial. How do you think that this bill will address those abuses?
Well, I think the area that will get the most attention is granting the telephone companies retroactive immunity. I think most of us understand that the telephone companies were acting under extraordinary pressure from the president. But we don't want this to be precedent for the future, taking away from our courts the ability to act as a check and balance on the president's powers. I think that is the most controversial provision here as to what the appropriate role of the court should be in this process. And quite frankly, I would like to strengthen the court's roles.
Do you believe that all wiretaps asked for by the executive should be warranted? In other words, should be submitted to a court and a warrant should be granted by a judge?
No, not at all. If it involves foreign surveillance, then where Americans are not involved, the intelligence community has current authority, and they should be able to proceed without getting permission from the courts. Our concern is when an American is a target or information is obtained from Americans, the intelligence community is aware of this. We want to make sure that Americans are protected, whether they're in the United States or abroad.
What do you think will be the effect on the 40 lawsuits that have been filed against telecommunications companies because of some of those wiretaps as a result of this bill passing, if it does indeed pass?
If the bill passes, there is a minimal court review of the process used by the telecommunication companies. I think most experts believe that if this legislation were passed, the telecommunication companies' lawsuits would be dismissed.
All right. I hesitate to ask you this, but have you made up your mind about this bill? You don't have to tell me what your vote is.
No, it's a comprehensive bill, so I have not made up my mind as to how I will vote if it's presented as a take it or leave it. I am hopeful that amendments will be in order. I certainly will support changes in the immunity sections. I think that that's not what we should be doing. On the other hand, I do believe that the intelligence community needs to have authority to deal with modern technology. There's no question that when you have what we call foreign-to-foreign communication that travels through the the United States, that the intelligence community needs to be able to gather that information when no Americans are involved.
Senator Benjamin Cardin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Democratic Senator Benjamin Cardin is one of the senators who will be voting on the FISA reauthorization bill. He's a senator from Maryland and is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
John, it's being called the biggest conservation deal in U.S. history. The state of Florida has struck a tentative $1.7 $5 billion deal to buy a sugar company and 300 miles of its land. It's a move that would help restoration efforts of the Everglades, and it's been hailed by environmental groups. It's also the state's largest land acquisition ever. Lots of history being made there. Damien Cave is following the story for the New York Times. And Damien, let me get this straight. The sugar company is selling their land for $1.75 billion. In return, they are going to go out of business. That right?
That's correct. They have 6 years to lease the land from the state and to continue their business as usual as they dismantle their company, basically, and then turn over the land and all the assets to the state. That includes a railroad, that includes orange groves, it also includes a sugar mill. So it's quite a momentous deal, and the state is getting quite a lot for its money, but a lot of things that you don't normally get in a land acquisition.
Okay. U.S. Sugar Corporation, which is one of the largest producers of sugar in the country, why in the world would they give up what has been a pretty successful business for this deal?
Well, they've had this business, for 77 years, and it's something that no one did think they would give up. But in recent years, they've had some trouble with a new mill that they put in, and the state really started to lean on them in terms of regulations. And so when the CEO went and told his workers yesterday why he sold out, one of the things he said is, listen, the state could push us off our land in other ways, not with $1.75 billion. There was a sense that the sustainability of the company was in question because of its location in a key area between Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades, because of the regulations, and also because of increased global trade. You know, a lot of sugar is coming in more from Mexico, and prices have the potential to drop. So the sustainability of the company, I think, was in question.
So the company is going to cash out while they can. And what does that mean for the Everglades? Are we talking about restoration to its original natural state, parts of it, all 300 miles?
Well, the Everglades will never be the Everglades like it was 150 years ago. There's just simply been too much development in South Florida. But this is a major boon to the Everglades because it is in a key location between Lake Okeechobee and Florida Bay, as I said. Now, how natural this will go back to is something that's still a matter of debate. Some of the folks in the water district, which will take control of the land for the state, suggest that there need to be reservoirs and pumps and different things to manage the water flow because you do still have development in certain areas, and the land has been used for so long by agriculture that it's simply not in its natural state. But a lot of environmentalists are very hopeful that this will bring them closer to a true Everglades as it was than ever before.
But Damien, it seems as though the environmentalists are really focused on the fact that, as you say, Lake Okeechobee is going to be reconnected to Florida Bay, the natural sort of water flow that was there for, I gather, tens of thousands of years is now going to be restored. That by itself will certainly change things.
Exactly. I mean, it's for a lot of these environmentalists, this is the culmination or the potential culmination of a major dream. I mean, they were giddy when I was talking to them yesterday. I mean, literally like kids in a candy store.
Giddy so environmentalists. I'm trying to visualize that, Damien.
Well, one woman said she would be doing cartwheels, so that should give you an idea.
Now I'm giddy.
So what happens next? This is a tentative deal. Does it need to be passed by the legislature? Does the governor need to sign it? What happens as this goes forward?
The governor and the CEO signed a statement of principles yesterday. It does not need to go through the legislature because the state has already created a mechanism for land acquisition for the Everglades. So basically, it in some ways goes through more of a corporate structure where the company's board and the company's shareholders need to decide if this is something that they want. And there will be difficult negotiations going forward between the state and the company over the exact nature of the land. In some cases, the land is not contiguous, so in order to figure out how the water flow would go from Lake Okeechobee South, they might have to swap land with other companies, and that could get complicated, too.
Okay. Damien Cave reporting from Florida for us, for the New York Times, on the Everglades and efforts to potentially restore them.
Thanks, Damien.
Sure. Sure, thank you.
That, of course, is a story on the front page of the New York Times. And, you know, really, environmentally, this is the equivalent of blowing up a dam, a big dam that has blocked a river for generations. I mean, this is a really big impact.
Like he said, like Damien said, it's going to be some very complicated negotiations before it's all said and done.
And giddy environmentalists.
Giddy.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. The phrase, if you see something, say something, is very familiar to people here in New York City. It's a sign of, what you're supposed to do if you see something that maybe is a little disturbing that might suggest
terrorism.
Terrorism, exactly. But what if you see something, say something, meant if you see something nice, say something nice? What would that sound like?
Hi, my name's Ray Cook from Elizabeth, New Jersey. My husband and I were living in Weehawken, New Jersey, several years ago. Driving home, he noticed that in the car behind us, the driver, a gentleman, was actually beating the woman in the passenger seat. My husband slammed on the brakes as she jumped out of the car. He rolled down the windows and screamed for her to get in our car, and ultimately ended up taking her to a friend's house.
We're asking for stories from you of acts of heroism, acts of selflessness that you witnessed, because we want a place for those stories. And we're going to talk in a moment about places that do exist for those stories. Here's another one.
I saw this guy waiting for a bus at 4th and the Bowery, and he was blind and he was having trouble boarding the bus. Mm-hmm. So I helped him board the bus.
What if there was a map you could open to find out where things like this have happened, say in the city of New York or anywhere in the United States, knowing in neighborhood by neighborhood, street by street, block by block, where good deeds were done? Technology is available to aggregate that kind of information, and here to talk about it is Alyssa Wright, who's a doctoral candidate at the MIT Media Lab and the creator of something called HeroReports.org, which, if I'm not mistaken, Alyssa, uses technology to take stories that you have asked for, solicited, of people's good intentions and tries to put them all in one place so you could get a bigger picture of, call it karma, I don't know what you would call it, of a city's good intentions. How does that work?
Well, we often call it civic courage. I mean, we have many ways of understanding the communities that we live in, whether this be crime reports that we call the school systems, and that there are other ways to understand and a more balanced way to understand our neighborhoods. So what we're often trying to do is, instead of having crime maps, that we have hero maps, and that this becomes more of a balanced way of understanding the spaces that we live in, that we work in. And
technology makes this possible now. Describe what HeroReports.org actually does. I mean, if I was to go to the website, what exactly would I see? What would I be invited to do?
Well, the main part of the website is a submission form, and it's much like an email space where you describe the incidents that you would like to report and the location that it happened. There are other ways of submitting reports. We're trying to make it as easy as possible for many different kinds of people to contribute to the conversation.
And we went out and actually solicited some stories from people that we found just here in the city, as you've been doing, and we were surprised how easy the stories came. It wasn't like people looked at us and said, "What are you talking about? Nice things? See something? Say something nice? What are you talking about?" Here's one.
And I saw this young man, maybe 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. He was just clinging to his chest, and I went up to him and said, "Are you okay?" And he shook his head, and I said, "Help!" And two other guys came over. One of them was an EMT guy, and
right.
He asked him if he had trouble breathing, and he said yes. He says he has a heart condition.
How do you think collecting stories like this and having a place where you can actually see them graphically in map form changes our understanding of our neighborhoods?
Well,
or adds to it even.
Well, I think we often look at our neighborhoods and where it doesn't work. And in terms of especially these crimes, and that by looking at it with both qualitative data and then aggregating it so that it becomes this powerful way of looking at our neighborhoods, that I even consider it as a subversive understanding, but also an economic contribution to our real estate. So that if you want to live in a neighborhood, it might have a lot of noise complaints, but it also might be a space that people are picking up the garbage on the streets or returning lost items, whether it be phones. In my neighborhood, we lost our cat for over 2 weeks, and it wasn't until somebody mentioned that there was this cat hanging out in the vet that we were able to find him.
So it's a question of filling in the picture. No place is ever all good or all bad, and from where you're sitting, a lot of time and energy has been spent on recording all of those bad things that are happening. And so you thought, we'll fill it in. We'll fill in all of those small acts that fill the entire story of what that particular neighborhood is about.
And there's a lot of effort right now to do that. But that effort is often around the complaints, the gripes, these are continuing things that either happens in the news media, but it also happens like on these social networks.
And I guess the theory that you're trying to push forward here, and you know, it reminds me of a lot of the work that's done at the Media Lab, is that if you give people the right invitation and also get them at the technology that's closest to their face or their hands or their action, you know, end. That people's impulse when they see something good like this will be instantly to put it online, to take it to a database. And the more you can kind of make this impulse really, really natural for people, the technology is really aiding a kind of revolution.
Right. I mean, exactly. If you know when there's a crime, you know to call 911. If you know there's a suspicious activity, or more like you suspect there's a suspicious activity, to find an MTA. Employee.
So you're the 911 of good karma. Alyssa Wright is the 911 of good karma. HeroReports.org is sort of that idea.
Yes.
That's terrific. So if you see something nice, say something, go to HeroReports.org. That's something that is tracking what's going on in New York City, but we also want to use our website at thetakeaway.org to get the same kind of picture for communities all around the nation. At the MIT Media Lab, Alyssa Wright, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now it's time for headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there, 28 minutes past the hour. Winfield, Missouri, the Mississippi River is just about to crest there. Thousands of volunteers are filling sandbags, hoping that the very fragile levee will actually hold. There's been a roadside bombing in northern Iraq, killing 3 American soldiers. And Tiger Woods is recovering from reconstructive surgery to his left knee. Presidential nominee Barack Obama is asking his top contributors to lend Hillary Clinton a hand to pay off at least $10 million of her campaign debt. Clinton supporters have been saying it would be money well spent. They say that if she's out of debt, she can raise some more money for Obama. Tibet is open to tourists again 3 months after the Chinese government banned visits, citing security concerns. The first group of foreign tourists arrived from Sweden later on today. And finally, the Millionaires Club needs a bigger clubhouse. The number of millionaires in the world has reached 10 million. That's up 600,000 from last year. Now, technically, they're not cash millionaires. They're high net worth individuals.
Is that what they say at the club? Yeah. It's like, I'm not sitting next to you. You're not an actual millionaire. You're just a high net worth individual, you know.
And the countries that see the biggest jump of millionaires, India, China, Brazil.
I can believe that.
Brazil, the developing countries.
Yeah. Are you sure Tiger Woods is actually having operation, or is he actually getting new eyes and robotic arms and legs installed?
The $6 billion
golf. Man.
Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. In the continuing and violent electoral crisis in Zimbabwe, a State Department official has said that the U.S. will not recognize the outcome of Friday's presidential election runoff in Zimbabwe. A group of Southern African leaders, meanwhile, are holding an emergency meeting in Swaziland to discuss the crisis. Members of the so-called Southern Africa Development Community, SADC Peace and Security Committee, are expected to discuss the possibility of a transitional government for Zimbabwe. The details of that are unclear. We're joined on the line by Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, that's the opposition in Zimbabwe, spokesman Roy Bennett in Johannesburg, South Africa. Mr. Bennett, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Roy, number one, it seems as though the international community has stepped up in a more aggressive way to protest what's been going on in Zimbabwe, but it also seems as though the position of the MDC, its power, seems to be eroding a little bit since the withdrawal of Morgan Tsvangirai from the election. Do you think this strategy is working for you?
Most definitely so, and I can't see how the power is eroding when there is no power in the first place. You have a totalitarian regime where the incumbent, Robert Mugabe, announces on three separate occasions, first, that he will never accept opposition governance, secondly, that bullet is mightier than the pen, and thirdly, that only God can remove him. On top of that, we clearly won an election on the 29th of March where President Tsvangirai won more votes than Robert Mugabe. We also have the majority in Parliament, so therefore we are now the ruling party, and Mugabe's lot are the opposition. As a result of that, unprecedented violence has been introduced, and the outcome of those elections was a foregone conclusion. We're not talking about elections here. We're talking about the transfer of power from a military totalitarian ruler.
Wishes
of the people of Zimbabwe.
Let me ask then, how do you get the international community to pressure Robert Mugabe to do something different? I mean, as it stands now, there will be this sham, as you say, of an election on the 27th. He'll still be in power the day after. At what point do you call for something more than just diplomatic pressure?
Well, basically, this is an African problem, needs an African solution. Clearly, SADC, the Southern African Development Community, have failed on this project. They are meeting today in an emergency summit. I think it needs the, or we, the MDC, think it now needs the involvement of the African Union, supported by SADC, in bringing about a resolution to this crisis.
What do you think? Hi there, it's Adora Udoji here. What do you think that the AU can do that the African, the 14 bloc nations of the in that region can't do?
Well, the African Union can bring in peacekeepers. The African Union adopt resolutions in supporting SADC around measures to bring the Mugabe government to account, to signatories of protocols towards the SADC norms and standards of elections.
So, Roy, let's just be clear. You are supporting essentially a form of military intervention into Zimbabwe in the form of AU-designated, AU-mandated peacekeepers, correct?
Yes, I wouldn't call it a military intervention. A military intervention is a different context.
I bet Robert Mugabe would call it a military intervention.
Well, that's fine, whatever he wants to call it. Basically, what you have is you have people in Zimbabwe being brutalized and killed by a regime. At some stage, there's a right to protect, and it's up to the African Union, together with SADC, to protect the people of Zimbabwe, where it is SADC that entered the fray after the beating of the leadership of the MDC in March 11th, to reassure the Zimbabwean people that they would be able to have free and fair elections. Those people have come out and they have voted, and they have voted very clearly, and now they are being brutalized and killed for the sake of their democratic will.
Roy Bennett, I just want to remind people you're a spokesman for a Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, and you mentioned SADC, which is the South Africa Development Community, which is the nation's meeting in Swaziland. Of course, the AU is the African Union. What is the message from your leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who, last report, is in the Dutch embassy in Harare? What's his message for the people of Zimbabwe at this moment?
His message to the people of Zimbabwe is that we will finish what we have started. We have time on our hands. The people must remain resolute. The people must remain strong and to know that they will prevail. We will never let them down. We will not be forced into a government of national unity. The people have spoken. We respect their will and we will deliver to them what they need, which is a new beginning, a new Zimbabwe.
So no support for a power-sharing government with ZANU-PF, the party of Robert Mugabe. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. We're talking about a transitional government where we would be part of a government with ZANU-PF in a transitional process to bring about the people's will, but certainly not a government of national unity that sees any involvement by Robert Mugabe or any leadership by ZANU-PF.
No involvement by Robert Mugabe. We'll see how it works out. Roy Bennett, a spokesman for the Movement for Democratic Change. Thank you. He spoke with us from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Now time for headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Hello there. 21 minutes to the hour. The Fed meeting wraps up today, but is unlikely to raise interest rates. President Bush and Iraqi President Jalal Talabani meet in Washington today to discuss a legal basis for U.S. troops to stay in Iraq. And former President Bill Clinton is offering to help Barack Obama take the White House. Three American soldiers and an interpreter are dead after a roadside bomb exploded in northern Iraq last night. Today in Baghdad, American soldiers using specially trained dogs are sifting through the wreckage of an office in Sadr City, where a bomb killed 10 people yesterday, including four Americans. And last night, the annual BET Awards were handed out in Hollywood. Alicia Keys, Kanye West, Halle Berry, Denzel Washington, they all went home with prizes. But it was the award for lifetime achievement that brought the crowd to its feet. Makes you want to go back to bed. Motown icon Al Green sang the 1971 hit Let's Stay Together. After the performance, the 62-year-old Green apologized for his performance, saying, "I'm sorry I didn't sing as well as I could. I got scared."
The Reverend Al Green, the master.
He got scared.
Wow. I love his music.
Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
We've been asking for your hero reports today, moments when you've witnessed, participated in, times when people have stepped in a selfless act and helped someone else. And here's what one of you told us.
This is Beth Engwall. I'm calling from Smithfield, Rhode Island. I was driving home from Maine after a weekend of camping with a friend. We were towing a pop-up trailer, which had been making a little bit of noise. So we're driving along, and all of a sudden, a man in a truck pulls up next to us quite quickly and signals for us to pull over. We pull over, and he says, you know, it's a good thing you stopped because one of the wheels on your trailer was about to fall off. And he said, I don't want you stopping for strangers, but I'm glad you stopped. And he magically pulled out all this material so that he could undo our tire and put on a new one for us.
Wow. That's amazing. I'm surprised those women stopped.
I know.
It's amazing.
But you never know. We want to hear your stories. You can drop us a line at mytake@thetakeaway.org or you can call us 877-8-MYTAKE.
Heroes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
So listening to Alyssa Wright talk about heroreports.org and how you can take these hero stories and put them on maps and create a new picture of your neighborhood, it reminded me of my own hero story.
I can't wait to hear this
now,
one.
When you're on a subway, you're sort of sitting there, you're in your own thing, you're in your own world, your own book, your own newspaper or anything. Well, I was on this subway. We were stopped at a station. The doors were closing. There were a number of people there. A woman had left the car, but I wasn't really paying attention. But on the bench of one of the seats was this abandoned bag, remember? Like a backpack. It's a little spooky, abandoned bag. It doesn't look good. Now, the doors were shut, but we weren't moving yet. Suddenly, this woman appears at the door and starts, pounding. And I look at her and I say, what's the problem? Just wait for the next car. I mean, what is your problem? She keeps pounding, though, and this older lady in about the middle of the car points to the abandoned bag sitting on the bench and says, it's her bag! Right. She'd gotten off the car. She'd forgotten her bag. She was going to leave her bag. And all of a sudden, this young, bearded, kind of Ethan Hawke-looking guy who was sitting there eating Indian food in the middle of the car and suddenly paying attention now, he's right next to the bag. He stands up, he looks at the woman, and starts motioning, like he wants to meet her at the next station, but the message is kind of unclear, and, you know, he's gesticulating wildly.
All of this
wildly.
Is happening in seconds.
Yeah, in seconds. And the car's now starting to move, see? The Ethan Hawke guy's solution was something like, you know, I'll email you, okay? You know, we're starting to move. This was clearly not going to work. We're picking up speed. The woman's getting frantic. I mean, this is a big bag. Everything of her life seems to be in this bag. Then all of a sudden, these two guys at the other end of the car, wearing headphones, they're kind of hip-hop guys, you know, they're talking loud, ignoring everybody in the car. They look around, they're paying attention now. We got it, they said. And one of the guys runs over to the bag. This was the amazing part. He picks up the bag. The other guy runs to the end of the car, opens the door, and walks through between the two cars, all right?
Because there's woman, that space.
Yeah, there's that space. Now, the woman is running down the platform after our car. She's watching her bag be manhandled by these hip-hop guys, right? All at once, the dude in the middle of the car tosses the bag across the car, all the way across the car, through the door. The other guy catches it, who's between the two cars, and at the last, absolute last possible second, he pitches it onto the platform just as we enter the tunnel.
Did she catch it?
Oh, yeah. She caught it. The bag landed right next to her. She grabs it through the window. We can see her jumping up and down doing this, you know. And
saying,
the woman's hugging her bag. Everyone on our car is cheering. Everyone in the subway car. I mean, it's electric. People are screaming. They're jumping up and down. We enter the platform, or we enter the tunnel, and we continue on our way. And by the time we get to the next station, everyone's sitting there back in the car, back in their book, looking at their newspaper. Silent. Absolutely silent. But you know what? It couldn't happen if all those heroes weren't on that car, right? Couldn't happen without the old lady noticing that the bag belonged to the lady who was pounding on the door, right? Couldn't happen without Ethan Hawke standing up and doing all these, like, you know, gesticulating things, right? Machinations. And the hip-hop dudes, of course, they were the biggest heroes of all, right?
Well, they got the bag to the woman.
They got the bag to the woman. I couldn't have figured that out.
It's interesting because everything that you just said is so instinctive. No one really had a whole lot of time to think. But all they knew is there was this bag and there was a woman who needed it.
And you know, when you're in a subway car in New York, when you're in a lot of places around the country, you feel like maybe these people aren't going to protect me. In that subway car, I was so safe. If anything had happened, we all would have been fine. That's my hero report, you know? I saw something and now I just said something. Hey.
Nice take.
Nice take. See something. It's the takeaway.
See something, say something. That's we want to hear your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Okay, folks, this just in, the universe has a problem that all of us would love to have.
Which is?
Well, the problem is the universe weighs a lot. It's the biggest thing in the universe, right? But it only weighs about 3/4 of what it should weigh. If you look at the universe, it looks like it weighs much less than it should. We'd all love to have that problem, right?
It looks like it weighs much less than it should?
You look so much lighter than you actually are. This is the problem the universe has. It's an enormous problem for physicists, it's an enormous problem for astrophysicists, and it's called the dark matter problem. The universe should weigh about this much, but we can't find the matter that ought to be there because of what we observe in the universe. And, you know, who can detect dark matter? Well, on the hunt in all of physics is our pal Neil deGrasse Tyson, host of WGBH's Nova Science Now, which kicks off its new season tonight on PBS. He's also the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. So, Neil, thanks for joining us. How close are we to finding all this dark matter?
Yeah, it depends on who you are. The particle physicists believe that they are hot on the trail of some mysterious particle not yet discovered that would account for this extra gravity that's out there. It's called dark matter, but a more accurate term would be dark gravity. So in other words, of all the gravity we measure in the universe, we can account for only about a sixth of it. Hmm. And that's the sixth that is the electrons, protons, neutrons, black holes, stars, gas clouds, everything that we consider normal matter that emits and absorbs and scatters light, that's 1/6 of all the gravity we see. And this problem's been around since the 1930s. It's the huge source of gravity, and we are dumb, stupid, clueless about what's causing it.
And around the world, there are detectors for these particles that you say, if we could detect them, it might begin to account for the dark matter. And neutrinos are one of the suspects, right?
Well, no. Well, neutrinos are ordinary matter, but they're sort of the writing on the wall for us, because mm-hmm. neutrinos, which were discovered, you know, 80 years ago, 70 right. years ago, were so they were hypothesized back, right. you know, in the early days of the 20th century. Neutrinos are an ordinary particle that barely ever interacts with the rest of ordinary matter. And so if that can
happen... Let's back up.
Oh, sorry.
What is a neutrino?
Okay, so we learn about electrons, protons, neutrons. There are other particles. They don't stop
Lots
there.
Of them.
A neutrino is just another particle. And it's it comes out of certain nuclear reactions that you can conduct in the laboratory.
And what does that have to do with dark matter?
What it has to do with dark matter is it's a particle that is so elusive that you needed extraordinary tools and methods to detect it. To the point where you had experiments that looked like, hey, something, there's some missing energy there. I wonder where it went. And someone hypothesized it left the room by virtue of some particle that we think carried that energy. And they said, what is it? And it's had to be neutral and little. So neutrino means little neutral one, actually.
Well, how do you detect stuff like this? And where do you go? I mean, it's not just...
Neutrino had its own challenges. Yeah. But the point is, it was the writing on the wall for the possibility that you could have particles that are living and working in space that have no interaction with anything you do or say or think.
But how then do you extrapolate to the idea that there is this dark matter which has never, ever been detected directly in any laboratory?
The difference
right?
is...
Right? And its existence has essentially been inferred by the fact that there's this belief there's so much gravity and you can only account for
yeah,
a certain...
You
can measure the gravity.
That's the difference.
Problem.
We're not just making this stuff up out of the ether. We measure this stuff.
See, I make stuff up. He doesn't make stuff up. See, that's
so
the difference.
Just because you don't know what it's made of and have never actually seen
How
it...
How do you measure gravity?
That's good. That's good. So we're in orbit around the sun at a certain speed. And you can take that speed. We've known this since the days of Newton. Take that speed and the orbit and the distance and calculate how much mass the sun must have. Okay? Now, suppose we were moving much, much faster at this distance. You would calculate a much bigger mass for the sun. Okay? You can do this for the entire galaxy. The galaxy of stars, the 100 billion stars in our galaxy. When you do that, you measure how much gravity should be, what the total mass should be in the middle of the galaxy, and you look around and add up all the stars, you get 1/6 of the total.
1/6.
1/6.
Wow. So you have gone on some interesting field trips to actually detect some of these dark matter particles that are theorized but have not been actually identified.
Right.
You just came back.
In the service of the segments of Nova Science Now.
Airs tonight.
Yeah, in fact, premieres tonight. Premieres tonight, Wednesday night.
New season.
And across the country. And 9 consecutive weeks on Wednesday night. But I went half a mile beneath Earth's surface to join some physics colleagues.
Where?
Particle physics. This is it's a iron mine, a defunct iron mine in Minnesota, actually. And why down there? Because there are other particles in space that could masquerade as the dark matter particle that they theorize. So they have to be shielded.
So why are you trying to find something in the galaxy underground?
Because this matter, which they believe is matter, by the way, you know the adage, if you're a hammer, then all your problems look like nails? So the dark matter problem, if you're a particle physicist, is imagined to be another particle.
But basically, the detector is guessing that there's a probability that of the particles that are streaming through us, these particles that don't interact with us, the dark matter, they still do have a chance of hitting something.
You're asking the right question. Here's the problem. Since we don't know anything about it, we don't know what it's made of, the detector that you design has to be based on some hypothesis that you have for what the dark matter could be.
This is a very controversial notion, though, right?
No.
The dark matter notion is not controversial.
It's measured.
Or how you look for it is not controversial.
So whose experiment might be the one that detects it is if it succeeds, then it vindicates not only the design of the experiment, but the hypothesis that led to that design.
And the iron mine that you went to is detecting through chemistry, right? Through the presence of chemical elements are a byproduct of collisions?
It's hypothesizing. Right. No, it wouldn't be chemistry. It would be nuclear. But
nuclear,
it hypothesizes that a dark matter particle would come in and hit a crystal and vibrate the crystal. It'll accidentally rub its elbow into the crystal as it moved through.
Over in Japan, there's a detector that's actually using light to try to see if they can
find to trigger a light signal, and then they have detectors for...
And it's a big pool of water buried way deep in the ground.
Yeah, so what you have are these experiments that are each following someone else, a theorist's idea about what the dark matter could be made of.
So you're looking in the ground... Because there is some thought that whatever the dark matter is has intermingled.
Yes.
And therefore would have to
You go in the ground just because you want shielding. You just want it.
It's too
easy,
much noise here in New York.
And the mines are, they're convenient, they're defunct, and they're available. So you go down. The funny part is watching these, you know, fully trained physicists in their sort of lab outfits going down these mine shafts. Elevators, you know, like what the old miners used to take.
These are telescope guys and particle guys going down in these elevators.
It's kind of the opposite thought of how you
what
you
do. What do you hope to learn when or if it's discovered what makes up dark matter? Why is that a good thing?
It's actually worse than that, because not only do we not know what 85% of all the gravity of the universe is, there's another feature of the universe that accounts for even more than that. There's this pressure that's making the universe accelerate, and we call that dark energy. We measure that, and we don't know what that is either. When you add up dark matter and dark energy, it's 96% of everything that drives the universe, which means we only know and understand 4% of the cosmos.
Wow.
So we've got a
long way to go. We got a lot of homework.
It's a humbling fact.
And also,
about our present state of the world. So you want to ask, what do we learn? We learn what our place is in the universe. Well, the more you know, it's your situational awareness. You move into a new house, you say, well, I wonder what the backyard is. I wonder what the nearest mall is. And that's kind of...
Where are the neutrinos? You always do that.
It's a natural urge. And if it's not your natural urge, it's the natural urge of others among us. And they're the ones who originally got us out of the cave in the first place.
and we thank them for that. Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and host of Nova Science Now. It kicks off its new season tonight on PBS. And, of course, Nova's from WGBH in Boston.
That's a natural urge.
Wednesday nights through August, natural urge. I like what he said. The takeaway for me is what he said about the mines. It sounds like a personal ad. Deep, defunct, and available.
Well... Folks, we want you to keep your responses coming to anything you've heard on today's show. Send us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Anything. U.S. and Iran, dark matter on Earth, hero reports on the subway. Here's one.
This is about the lost cat, which was found in Brooklyn, which was lost for a while. And somebody picked her up and took her to animal healing arts. And when I returned from Europe from the trip, I found the cat there. And I want to thank them. I want to thank the neighbors and everyone who found her to take care of her and be such a good neighbor and such a kind person.
I'm going to cry.
Wow.
That is fabulous.
No, that's a beautiful story. The conversation does continue at thetakeaway.org.
You can also see a video from our producer, crack producer Jim Colgan. Actually, he has nothing to do with crack. On the New York subway telling us about their acts of courage, his video about acts of courage. And the Facebook game, tell us about that quickly.
Yeah, it's the 2008 Deep Stakes. You can buy and sell potential running mates for Barack Obama and John McCain.
Always on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.